Hey guys, it's Jessica, founder of Noonday Collection. Welcome to the You Matter podcast. On this podcast, I want you to get ready to be inspired to be more courageous and to own your worth. Get ready to feel connected to the artisan community and to the community where you have a place of belonging, the ambassador community. Because the truth is, you matter, and I'm so glad you're here. Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to another episode of You Matter. So much fun to get to sit down today with Samuel. He is the founder of Noah's Ark, which is an organization that we work with in India. They've done a lot of our favorite jewelry items, and now they're actually going to be, in addition to the other group we work with, they're going to be making our modern leather tote. So I told him to watch out. But in this episode, you're going to hear his founding story, which, as you're going to see, has a lot of hustle, a lot of hitting the pavement. And I think it'll come as a lot of encouragement to you as you are going to hit the pavement so hard this fall, which we really cannot wait. You're also going to hear about how the name of Noah's Ark came to be, and you're going to hear more about where he sees the future of his organization and how Noonday can be a part of that. So tune in. So thanks so much for coming to Austin. Yep. I know that you're hitting up a few different places this time around. When was your last time in the U.S.?
I was here last year also.
Last year, yeah, okay.
I was supposed to come to Austin, but things didn't come up. So that's why I couldn't come last year.
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, and I love that you were able to just rattle off the numbers of Noonday for since we started working with you. So why don't you share with our ambassadors really quickly the percentage of growth that, Noonday's had in your business over the past 3 years?
Yeah. Our financial year starts from April. April ends in March. So the figures I will tell you from starting from April to March.
Okay.
So, 14-15, during the year of 2014 and 15, the turnover with Noonday was something around $15,000.
Okay.
Then 15-16, it was like $38,000. So,
okay,
it was, I would say, somewhere 2.5 times increase.
All right.
And then in 16-17, it was $55,000.
Okay.
So it was like 1.5 times increase over the previous year.
Wow.
Yeah.
So a lot of growth.
Yes.
And your group now is about to start also making the modern leather tote.
Yeah.
Which has been a top selling product for us for years. So do you have a prediction? What's your prediction of growth for us?
Well, I think with these bags, in 2017-18, it should go somewhere. It should triple.
Awesome. Let's do it.
Yeah.
Let's do it. Well, awesome. Well, I love you sharing your story of how you came to do what you're doing. And I know you've shared it a lot. You just shared it with us this afternoon as an office, which thank you so much, because everyone just loves, you know, people here are kind of grinding away. They're behind computers and it's so good for them to get to hear about the result of the other side. So why don't you share a little bit? You grew up in Moradabad, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, so you grew up in Moradabad, which, as you shared today, has a hundreds of year history in crafts.
Yeah.
And tell us a little bit about what you went to college for, and then how you came to start working in the craft sector in India.
Yeah, I was born and got my education in Moradabad itself. And in Moradabad is a town of about 20 square kilometers, and almost 900,000 people are living in that town.
So it's packed.
Yeah. And I would say 60% of the population is doing or related to making handicrafts, exporting handicrafts.
Wow.
So it's kind of a handicraft town, I would say.
Okay.
And the whole economy of the town depends on the handicraft orders, and be it the Indian market or overseas market. We have about 3,000 exporting units also in Moradabad. So about that, our town is also called the Brass City.
Brass City.
Brass City.
Okay.
Because like 30 years back, 20 years back, the production was 90% production was the brass products.
Wow.
Made of casting brass, made of sheet brass, okay. And then fine hand carving used to done on that brass products. And they do all kind of different things like utensil in brass, t-shirts in brass, table in brass, lampshades. So the stories goes like 350 years back, when the king was traveling to this area, and his troops, they stayed back in the town, and they had some craftsmen. So these craftsmen started producing the utensil for their use. Utensil mainly made out of brass and copper.
And it was for his kingdom?
Yes, for their personal use only.
Okay.
And gradually the work was extended, and the artisan at that time started producing these utensils for the public also and selling it. Because in India, till 50 years back, we never used stainless steel.
You'd never used it. No, it was always just brass.
It's the brass or copper we used to. We used to drink water in copper glass and used to have the brass glasses, brass pots, brass utensils, and brass spoons. So all these things were made in brass, and for safe use, we used to electroplate it with.
Okay.
Yeah. So this was the history goes. But gradually, after the Britishers came, they starting making these products, like they turned the products into more decorative.
Okay.
Like flower vases,
okay.
Ashtrays, and in this way, in last century, they started making the product and exporting it to UK.
Okay.
So in this way, this process was started. But the pickup of the real export or the boost of the exports was somewhere in 1916-70.
Okay.
And then lot of industry or small exporting units were established there, and they started exporting the brass things. But after a few years, like till 80 or I would say 1990, after 1990, the trends started changing because the brass and the copper price were increasing every year. So the artisan, they started using different material, experiment with different materials, and like aluminium, iron, and stainless steel also. And they started experiment with by making different items also, like from home decoration. They started producing jewelry also, bangles also, cuff made out of brass or copper. So in this way, now the whole concept of the production has changed now. So it is more mixed material.
Okay. So if about 70% of your village was crafts,
yeah.
Was your family in the craft sector?
No, my family was not, because my father was in government job.
Okay.
And after finishing my education, I was in the same business, started doing the same thing. And there I felt the need to start a business, a small business, which could help the small artisans or grassroots artisan with the orders, with the production, or establishing a small workshop in their houses, or give them some facility like finances, or maybe take care of their health. So in this way, this what Noah's Ark was started more like a social company.
And so what was it for you? We have this term in America that we say, waking up. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, when I just actually got back 2 days ago from Africa, mm-hmm. and I took my children with me. Mm-hmm. I have 2 8-year-olds and an 11-year-old.
Oh, okay.
And so much of this is wanting them to just be exposed and to understand mm-hmm. that America has a lot of privilege and opportunity, and we're supposed to use that privilege mm-hmm. and opportunity to help others. So I'm hoping that they are going to live an awake life. And so what do you think caused you to sort of wake up and think, like, you know, these artisans need some business help and they need some extra help to not be so marginalized?
I started Noah's Ark in 1986, and before that, for 4 years, I was doing same kind of work, but with a different person. And there I saw that my work was mostly office-related, getting the orders, but the production side was someone else who was looking after the artisan and the production. There I felt that the artisans were not getting the right wages.
Okay.
They were paid late, and also, I mean, they were not giving kind of facility what we should have given as an organization.
Okay.
So there I felt, after 3 years, I started feeling something, that something is wrong here.
Mm.
The artisans are not treated well, or their payments are held back for 2 months. Like, so there I started feeling that, I talked to the artisans also, some of the artisans. So they came forward, they said that you should start a business which could help the artisan.
Mm.
So that idea gave me and that kind of courage to start a business with a couple of artisan groups
mm.
in 1986.
Wow. Yeah. So you were really ahead of your time, because this was before fair trade. This is before social enterprise was even a thing. But it was just out of knowing, hey, I'm gonna help others and treat them the way they deserve to be treated.
Yeah, when we started in 1986, the fair trade term was not very common or not heard of that. I mean, more it was, you can say it was a social business, that if you are helping someone, it's more related to the social work. So in this, the concept was like a social or social work
mm-hmm.
that was started like that. And then the term fair trade came in 1989 or 90.
Okay.
So it was more related to Ford work, fair trade now.
Okay. And tell us about the name. How did you first hear the story of Noah and his ark? And how did you decide the name to business that?
Yeah, the thing is that since I'm a Christian, I heard the story of Noah's.
Uh-huh.
So the idea came in my mind that like Noah's Ark, we should provide shelter for every kind of handicraft and handwork.
Okay.
So that's why the name Noah's Ark was given.
Okay. Now, how did you become a Christian? Because there aren't very many Christians in your country.
Actually, my grandfather, he was converted back.
Okay. And then so it's from your family.
From family, yes.
Okay. So that's how you came to name it Noah's Ark.
Yes.
I loved hearing that story.
Pleasure.
Okay, so I loved hearing about your hustle and about, is that a term that y'all use at all? Hustling, like hitting the pavement, hustling. It just means like working really, really hard. And you did that when you had this situation happen where you sold product to someone on consignment and then he couldn't deliver.
Yeah.
And so you were in all this debt. And you were like, okay, I got to go do something about this. And so tell us about that story, because I think it will really help our ambassadors. Because
mm-hmm.
There's a lot of similarities between what you did and what mm-hmm. they're doing every single day.
Okay. So the stories or the event goes, the time goes somewhere in, I would say, 1987.
Okay.
And I know someone in Indianapolis, Indiana, and he was from India also.
Okay.
And he was unemployed. He moved from India in 1986, so it was, he was employed. He wanted to do some business, so he asked me to send, he selected some items, and we sent, we produced the goods for him. It was like somewhere like $10,000 at that time. And we never had money also. We took loan from the bank, and we sent the goods to him in the beginning of 2006 or 1986 or 87, somewhere, I don't. And what happened that even after 6-7 months, he was not able to make payment.
Mm.
And we were reminding him, our bank was asking for the money. So he said that I can't pay you because I'm not able to sell the goods. So what I did, I decided to come to US and try myself to sell off these goods. And so then I came here, and somewhere in 1988, January, I think. And I know someone in Minnesota, in Bemidji area. And then I talked to this person.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a big house, and the basement was almost empty. So he asked me to bring the goods there. And so we hired a truck, and we took delivery from this person in Indianapolis and brought the goods to Bemidji. And then what I did, I started selling these goods by myself. Every day I used to drive car by filling the goods.
Okay.
And selling to the gift shops and the floral shops in the area.
So would you just load up your car?
Yeah.
And then you would look up maybe where certain, because it was mainly vases.
Yeah, it was mainly gifts and
gift vases. Items. Yeah, so yeah. Then you would just go like knock on doors.
Yes.
And say, here are my goods.
Yeah, yeah. And the shop owners, they were interested because they don't have to pay any freight.
Right.
And they were getting the goods right from the car. And even I used to open the goods to show them if they like the quality, or if they don't like, they can return it and I can give them the other piece.
So how long did it take you to sell through all of that?
Oh, it took me almost 45 to 60 days to sell off everything.
So you were just hitting the pavement every day.
Yeah, yeah, every day I used to drive.
You were selling.
Yeah.
You were selling.
So after 60 days, I had sold all my goods and sent back money to India to the bank. And then these shop owners, they were calling me for more goods, and they wanted to have more goods because they have sold off. So what I decided, I started buying the goods locally from Atlanta, Georgia, and started distributing that goods to these shop owners. And I did maybe a couple of months more like that. And then one day I was visiting a small gift shop in Sioux Falls.
Uh-huh.
And there was a small... there was a magazine on it, and it was, there was a, in the magazine, there was an advertisement about the Sullivan Florist. They were a big wholesale florist based in Sioux Falls.
Okay.
And they were carrying same kind of things which I was carrying.
Okay.
And the wonderful part was that these things were not mine.
Uh-huh.
I had bought some from somewhere else, like in Atlanta.
Right.
So what I did, I worked on the prices, and I called for an appointment. And this owner, she gave me appointment for the next day. I stayed back in Sioux Falls. And then when next day I went there, we had a good meeting. And then she handed me over She handed me an order of about $70,000.
That is crazy.
Yes.
So you saw a magazine.
Yeah.
You saw like, oh, I could provide that.
Yeah.
And you called her up.
Yeah.
She took the appointment and then she gave you $70,000 order.
Yes. And the thing is that you can imagine that the samples which I was carrying was not mine.
Right, right. So you had to go and create your own.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I went back. So that was the turning point of our business.
Your whole business.
Yes, whole business, yeah.
Wow.
And
what do you think it was that she took a chance on you like that?
I don't know. I exactly know, but it was when she handed me a card of her. In the back, it was written that if we meet and forget, it's nothing. But if we meet God and forget Him, it's everything.
Wow. Wow. So you felt almost like it was a divine appointment,
maybe.
Yeah.
So that was the turning point.
That was a turning point.
I went back to India and started working on it, talked to the bank. They were ready to finance because she had opened a letter of credit.
Okay.
So it was started like that. Then I got this order in 1989.
Mm-hmm.
And immediately I came back. We started expanding our place.
Mm-hmm.
So we were able to expand a little bit. And then in 2003-04, we expanded like 9,000 square, 10,000 square feet.
Wow.
And, yeah.
That's huge.
And then last year we built the new place, which is about 30,000 square feet now.
It's crazy. I know my team has been there and just said it was incredible, which is so exciting because I know in Muradabad, it's so hard to control the toxins and even, you know, just on my trip to Uganda, they have a very small workshop there that works on cow horn earrings,
mm-hmm.
so horn earrings, and other little pieces for our some paper bead necklaces that we sell. And it was hard for some of the ambassadors because they walked in and the guys are working on the floor. They're not wearing masks.
Mm-hmm.
They were like, what's happening? And, you know, my encouragement was it's little by little. You know,
yes.
And so right now, this is what we're seeing. This is the basic. This is creating a dignified job where
mm-hmm.
they're getting paid well. And then little by little, we introduce like wear a mask.
Mm-hmm.
Here's how to keep things clean.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually, like what you did now, you're able to really oversee safety and probably all the things that were hard for you in the past when you would go and visit the home workshops.
Yeah, when we started, it was very difficult to keep the standard for the artisans. But gradually, we provided them training. We provided them safety gears.
Mm-hmm.
And also, three years back, we in some of, almost eight in of our main workshops, we installed completely ducting system to suck the dirt.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So gradually we started these things, the safety standard implementing in the artisan's workshop. Then at our place, we installed the water treatment plant where all the water is treated. And then we had these... we have a system to check the air quality.
Okay.
Yeah. And then we have a system of checking the smoke from the generator if we have
to
run.
Right.
We have to see the emission.
Okay.
So
okay.
All the system we could place
in
place, yeah.
Right. And so tell us a little more about your social enterprises and when you realized that you were profitable enough as a company to
mm-hmm.
then begin providing additional support for your
mm-hmm.
artisans. How
mm-hmm.
did you first identify what the needs were in the community? And then how did you go about addressing those needs through your business?
Mm-hmm. We bought a land in a remote area.
Okay.
And there was all field around, and we saw children working in this field, in the field around, and along with their parents, and they were not going to school.
Mm.
So
what were they doing in the field? Was it crops?
Were picking up the crops. Yeah.
Okay.
So that was the time when we thought that we could start something like a small schooling project for these children. And that was started somewhere in 2003, I think, four or five, yeah. So we talked to their parents, and initially they were all not interested. But when we
told them... Because then they would lose the money,
yeah.
right? Okay.
But when we told them that we will provide free education, free books, free uniform, then they started sending their children gradually. And it picked up in 2007-8.
Okay.
So from here, 50 children at that time.
Wow.
Now we have 350 children.
Wow.
All together in three places.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so now it's been more than 10 years.
Yes.
So does someone really stand out in your mind? Like someone that you thought, oh my gosh, this family, maybe they'll never really value education.
Yeah.
And now, wow, the mom comes and picks her child up from school. Yeah. Or can you tell us a story about a family that you've really seen advance over the last years?
Well, I remember one of our artisans, his name was, let me remember exactly his name. His name is Khalil Ahmad.
Khalil Ahmad?
Yeah, yeah. So we started working with him, and he had five children, three boys, two girls. The girls were older, and they were not going to school at all. So we asked him to, when we started this school project in that village, we asked him to send both of these girls to our schooling project, and they started coming to the school, and gradually they started learning, and they picked up quite well. And in 2013, I think, they did their high schooling, and then both of them, they went for the nursing.
Wow.
So that was...
That's
something.
Huge,
yes.
Especially it's a Muslim family.
Yeah, yeah.
And traditionally, there isn't a high value on
yes.
girls getting educated.
Yeah.
That must have been so fulfilling for you
to
get to see that.
Yeah.
Wow. And so tell us a little, India has changed so much over your short, young life. And so tell me a little bit about... at the beginning, you saw exploitation, you saw artisans not getting paid well. In 2003, you're seeing children that aren't in school. What are some of the issues that are facing your community today where you think, gosh, if Noonday could just keep growing and we could keep getting more orders,
mm-hmm.
Here's the impact that we could continue to make on my community?
But the thing is that what I feel that I come from Muradabad, and it was all handicrafts all around.
Mm-hmm.
And the artisans, they were doing small work in their houses. And gradually, the traditional work was losing out.
Mm-hmm.
So these small workshops, they started closing down.
Right.
So it was loss of traditional work also. It was loss of culture also.
Mm.
So that was what was our thinking, that how we can, and it was a challenge also, that how we can transform these artisans to make something else.
Right.
So there are so many artisan workshops in Muradabad. We can't do everything for everyone.
Right.
So we did some experimenting, and we trained these artisans to different trade.
Okay.
Maybe doing the iron work, doing the aluminium work,
right.
Or maybe doing the wire work also. They are
okay.
doing, making the bangles, wire bangles, etc. So in this way, it is still a challenge that how we can bring the artisan back to their
Okay.
original trade.
Okay.
Yeah.
So creating more jobs really
More
for the
jobs,
artisan.
yes.
Okay. Because you've seen a lot of loss of those jobs, and I'm sure that's really impacted Muradabad.
Yes, it has impacted, yes. Yeah.
Okay. So I would love for you to share now. So Noah's Ark is going to be making, in addition to the other group we've been working with, it's going to start making our modern leather tote. And so tell us a little more about that goat leather process. How do they acquire the hides, and then how do they treat them?
In India, most of the goat leathers come from the slaughterhouses because the goat meat is very popular and in India, and mostly the people who are slaughtering the animals are Muslims, and then the people who are processing the leather are Hindus.
Okay.
Yeah. And the hides comes with the, and it's a small workshop,
Okay.
and he dips this hide dip hit these hides in the water,
Okay.
plain water, for 15 days, and all the hairs are cleaned,
Okay.
and then it is dried. The another thing is that this is most of this goat leather, natural leather, is processed in Rajasthan or Rajasthan area because of the plenty of sunlight there. Yeah. So after cleaning this thing, they put it in the lime water.
Okay.
Yeah, and
So that's up in Jodhpur.
yeah, Jodhpur. Yeah,
Jodhpur.
yeah.
Is that the city that's blue? Is that the blue
Yes,
city?
the blue city.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, this is a great excuse for me to get to go up there sometime.
Okay.
I love Rajasthan.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's in Jodhpur, and so there's a lot of sunlight.
Yeah.
So do they not get the monsoons?
They get the monsoon, but it's not very long.
It's not as long as other parts. Okay.
So they clean and then treat it with the lime water, and then again clean it, and then they dry it in the drum, in
Okay.
the drum, rotating drum, and then again dry it. So in this way, hide is done in
Okay.
Jodhpur, yeah.
And then they then sell that to, do they sell those hides, or are you purchasing the hides from the beginning?
No, they sell these hides.
They're selling those
Not
hides to now
to
the
yes.
artisan you're working
Yeah,
with
yeah.
in Delhi
In Delhi.
that has all the leather
Yeah.
machinery that you've been working with for, you said,
Yeah,
so many years.
we have been working with him since last maybe 7, 8 years.
Okay.
He used to make the fabric bag for us,
Okay.
and then we had demand, some of our buyers did demanded the mixture of material like fabric with
With
leather.
leather,
Yeah.
yeah. Because I think the end customer really feels like leather adds more of an expensive
Yeah,
feel to a bag.
yes.
Okay. So he's been working with leather
Yeah.
machinery. So did you help him purchase that machinery?
Yes.
Okay. And but it's been like 7 years since you purchased that machinery.
No, we the leather machine the leather work we started, like, I would say somewhere about 2 and 1.5 year back.
Oh, okay.
So recently, last year, we got him the machinery,
You got him
leather
machinery.
machine, yes.
Okay. I bet that's helped him increase his business
Yes,
again.
yes.
Okay. That's really cool. And so, I'm just thinking, India is really big. And so, logistically, you've got the hides, and then the hides make it down to Delhi to this workshop. And then, do they then come to Muradabad for inspection and finishing? Or,
Yes,
okay.
it comes to Muradabad for inspection
Okay.
and finishing, yes.
And is it like, do you have a post office, or how does everything make it from one city to the next?
From Delhi, it takes only night to come to Muradabad, isn't
Okay,
it?
okay.
It's in the morning, it's in Muradabad, so yeah.
Well, we're excited to hopefully you will see a big increase in our orders. So tell us a little bit more then about some of the other social programs, because you were sharing with us today, you've got the school, and then what are some of the other ones?
We are running a clean drinking water project also.
Okay.
That's how we can provide clean drinking water in the artisan homes and workshops.
Mm-hmm.
So under this project, what we are doing, we are distributing water filters.
Okay.
To the artisans.
Uh-huh.
And also we are giving them access to the water 24 hours, that how they can get, because in India they don't get water 24 hours, or many of the house and workshop, they don't have even the pipeline for the water.
Okay. What percentage of your artisans do you think have running water in their home?
I would say maybe 30%.
Okay. So the rest of them are needing to walk to a well.
No, they have the shallow hand pump in their
a
houses.
A hand pump. Yeah. Okay.
So what we are doing, after checking the proper depth of the hand pump,
okay,
we attach a motor
to
that hand pump.
Wow.
And through the water fittings, we put up a tank of 500 liter on the top of their house.
Oh.
So they can pull the water and store in the tank.
Oh, that's great.
In that way, they have water.
So it's rainwater. Rainwater. No. It comes from the well, pumps up to the tank, and it stores there. Even when the well's not working, they can have it. Okay. And then filters as well.
Yes.
Okay.
And other project we are running a stitching school also.
Okay.
Where these girls, young girls, who are coming to learn the stitching skills. And after completing a year, they can start working their own. Maybe most of them, they are trying to stitching the Indian dresses from their houses.
Okay.
They can earn well. And right now they are very busy because we are getting orders. And these girls, they do some of the bags also.
Okay.
Pouch bags.
Okay.
They make pouch bags also, and they stitch all the labels by hand.
Oh, wow.
The buyer's label.
So even our label for the leather bags, would they be stitched by these women?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So when those bags come from Delhi to Muradabad to get finished, that's when those women are stitching in. Wow. And those women are working from home. Are there still issues with the families that you work with where they don't want the woman to leave the home?
No, I don't think so, no.
Not as much anymore?
Not much anymore.
In your community? So it's okay for the woman to come? And
yeah.
Do they come to your workshop to do the sewing, or do they do that from home?
No, we have this workshop.
Okay.
It's a stitching center. They come there.
They come to the stitching center to stitch in. Okay. How many people, like if you think about, how many more people could you provide jobs for?
Well, it depends on the...
Like when you think about the people that are available to work and then the need, is it...
I think we can provide 100, 250 people more.
More,
yeah.
Okay. And how many people are you employing right now?
We are about 90, 92, 93 people.
Okay. Yeah. And are those people that are just on your payroll?
Yeah.
These and then there's also the independent artisans that you're purchasing from.
Yes. There are another, I would say somewhere 250 to 300
artisans. A network. Okay.
Network,
so about 400 artisans in all that you're
working
impacting.
Yes.
Okay. But you could see that growing.
Yeah.
We would love to see it grow.
Okay.
Every summer, our ambassadors, our saleswomen, go on trips to visit the artisans.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just had about 100, over 100 women go to Guatemala and Peru and Uganda and Haiti. And so I have so many women asking me, we want to go to India.
Okay.
They want to come so badly. And so what do you, if we planned a trip to India, like where would you suggest that we go? Would we come to Muradabad to see your workshop? Like what would be our itinerary, do you think?
I think you can come to Delhi.
Okay.
And Delhi is about 160 kilometers from Moradabad.
Uh-huh.
So because we get groups.
Yeah.
Often we get groups from overseas coming.
Okay.
Yeah, the latest one is coming in October from UK.
So do you take the train or do you take a van to Moradabad?
There is a train also.
Okay.
And we can arrange a van also if you want to come. So
do people just come for the day or do they usually spend the night?
They come for a day.
Okay.
Yeah. Or if they are traveling, some of the people there, they want to travel to Taj also. So then that case, they stay in the night and then next morning they go to Taj.
Okay.
Or the another possibility from Delhi, you go to Taj. From Taj, you can come to Moradabad.
Okay.
And then go back to Delhi. So that is also a possibility.
Yeah. We work with, are you familiar with Pushpanjali?
Yes, in Agra.
We work with them as well.
Mm-hmm.
He actually came to our conference in January and spoke.
Okay.
So maybe you'll come someday and speak to all of our ambassadors.
Yeah.
So what would you say to the women that are out there right now? They're driving just like you drove around that time in Minneapolis. They're driving to a trunk show to unload their cars, to ask people to buy. What would you say to encourage those women?
I would say that they can try their best because it's not the product, it's the feeling of the artisan also attached to the product. And never be discouraged because they are doing something very beneficial and something good for the artisan. And we always tell them, tell the artisan about the stories that how easy it is to make the product, but how difficult it is to sell, and the risk involved you people take, because you never know that whether the product will sell or not.
Mm.
Because our responsibility stops when we send the goods.
Mm.
From there onwards, your responsibility starts.
That's so true.
Yeah.
So our responsibility is to sell the product.
Yes, that is the greater responsibility.
So that we can keep buying more.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. It was great to get to meet you.
Okay.
It's my first day back in the office in like a month. And so this is a great way for me to get to come back to work.
And you let me know when your next conference is. I will try to be there.
I will.
Okay.
I will. Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation. It was really so great to get to sit down with Samuel on my first day back in the office after almost a month of being out. You know, I always come back from Africa just like I took a really, really cold shower. It's always a wake up for me. It stirs me. It makes me remember why we do what we do. And so to get to spend my first day back in the office with Samuel, with him reminding me to do what we do, because like he said, our responsibility is to go and sell the product so that we can make reorders so that his artisans can have more work. And so that's what we get to do. We have the privilege and honor of representing these artisans of Moradabad, India, and selling their product so that we can create more flourishing for them and their community. So let's go do it. Okay, I heard rumors in Uganda that some of y'all don't like to hashtag You Matter because you think I'm going to call you out and then ask you to be on a You Matter podcast. So let's just dispel that right now. And I would love to hear what your takeaways are. It helps with our future episodes. It helps us know what motivates you. And again, I just love getting to read your comments. So head on over to the Facebook page and hashtag You Matter and let's start a conversation.